1984, and we're continuing our interview with Dr. Zalman Shapiro. And the tape we finished, we were in the middle of a sentence on nuclear reactors and Admiral Rickover, and I thought maybe you'd like to continue your experience with this man and the year that that took place, that you met him and you were working on your nuclear reactor out at Westinghouse, or at Bettis, right?
Well, it's Westinghouse. Bettis was a laboratory operated for the government by Westinghouse.
Okay.
Well, actually, I think I mentioned previously that I started at Bettis in February of 1949, and I was one of the first few employees at Bettis, and that we were located in the hangar and so on and so forth.
Right.
I was responsible at that time for chemical metallurgy, and specifically my project was to prepare or invent, develop a method for the preparation of ultra-pure zirconium, which is an element which was used as a cladding material for nuclear reactors, and the reason for that is because it's transparent to neutrons. And up to this point, very little pure material had been prepared, and it was extremely expensive. It cost something like $1,000, $1,200, $1,500 a pound. And obviously, you can't build anything large of material that costs that much. And furthermore, the material that was being made at the time was very impure, and even the so-called pure material. And it was not reliable in its action. And so I was charged with the responsibility of developing a technique for making the material so that it could be, so that its performance was reliable and predictable. And I was fortunate in being able to do that, and we later built a plant in record time, and that took a tremendous amount of effort and energy. I spent as I was saying, he cited me as one of the four people most responsible for the success of the
Admiral Rickover
of the Nautilus. You know,
what year was this?
Well, we worked on it from 49, and the boat was launched in 53. It was done in record time, and for this, the company awarded me their Silver W, which is their Medal of Merit. And I guess I was the youngest person who had ever received it, and I had only been with the company 5 years. So I guess that was a first. But in any event, during the course of all this, Rickover used to make his nocturnal visits to the laboratory, and he visited me in the laboratory a number of times to spur me on in his own inimitable way.
But he wasn't a scientist, was he?
He was an engineer.
Oh, he was.
He graduated from the Naval Academy in Annapolis. I don't know that he claims he's a scientist, but he certainly claims he's an engineer. Although he's been in administrative work for essentially all of the time that he's been in the Navy. But he's administered a technical project
What do you mean by nocturnal visits?
Evening.
Well, he used to come. His favorite time to visit was at night. His meetings used to start, he'd come around 6 o'clock in the evening, and his meetings would go on 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10, 12 o'clock. And then he visited me in the laboratory once at 1 o'clock in the morning. There were some pretty funny stories about all of his business, but I won't burden you with these.
I think that'd be a highlight.
He's a peculiar guy. A very peculiar guy. He's got... and in many respects, the man is a great man in that he was responsible for pushing through this project in spite of the fact that the Navy was against it. And they thought that conventional submarines were better. But in spite of all of that, he dedicated his life to this, and he pushed it through in spite of all of the opposition on the part of the regular Navy. What he did was he worked directly with the Congress and was able, by in effect going over the heads of the people of the Navy, accomplish a great many things. They obviously couldn't fire him. They couldn't do anything to this guy. And he was as far as they were concerned, he was a pariah. But at the same time, while he had his greatness, he was also a very petty man. And very vindictive character. And once you were on his list, that was you were really in trouble. And the result was that we had managers come and go like people in a streetcar. As a result, his philosophy in management apparently was a new broom sweeps clean, so he had lots of new brooms. And any time anybody crossed him in any way whatsoever, out they went.
He's lucky you didn't cross him.
I don't know that he's lucky that I didn't cross him. I left Bettis and... 57 to start my own business, and I wrote to him at that time and told him I was going to do this, and subsequent to that I was on his list, and he did some things which were really literally terrible.
You mean unforgivable?
He blacklisted me. He told people at Bettis not to deal with me, and he told people at the Knowles Atomic Power Laboratory, which was the counterpart that GE was running, not to deal with me. And he even
we're recording the dog, in the background. Just wanted to explain that for some future historian.
It's a very sensitive. Good background for this guy.
Yeah, he's a dog. I spoke to a friend of yours in Florida. His name is Schultz.
Monty Schultz.
Monty Schultz, who said almost what you're saying about him. So I guess everybody had a problem with him. Is that true?
I don't know.
Pretty much.
I don't know that everybody had a problem with him, but lots of people had problems.
Yes,
with
yes.
Did that make it very difficult for you in your new business?
It was in spite of all of the, in spite of him that we were able to succeed. He was, eventually he came through his lieutenants at Bettis. They called on me and asked me to help. They had some problems they had to overcome. So I guess at that time it was it was okay for him to get me back. I was hardly in good graces, but when he needed me...
He needed you. But the result is on your wall. Isn't that the nuclear summary? Is that the Nautilus up there?
Well, the result of what I did at Bettis is on the wall,
that's
right?
That's what I mean, yeah.
But all of this was subsequent to the Nautilus. I left Bettis, as I said, in 57.
Before it was
launched?
Oh, was it launched?
Yeah. It was launched in 53.
And it was the first one of its kind, is that correct?
It was the first nuclear submarine.
Can you tell us any other incidents or awards in your career? There's some awards you haven't mentioned, because I looked around here and saw some.
Well, let's see. I guess there's some things I guess I don't have up, but I was awarded where I had my business in the Kiske Valley. The Kiske Valley Association awarded me a plaque for industrial appreciation. We had started a business in that area, which provided employment for quite a few people.
Was that the Apollo company?
That was the Apollo plant.
Mm-hmm.
That was a Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation. And I was awarded, way back in 45, I got a citation from the National Research Council for my work during the war. And I was also cited for my work by the American Nuclear Society for the work that I had done on zirconium. And there were other things associated with community work. This thing pertained to the this graduate rabbinical academy, which is the Kollel.
Yeah, I know.
And then the Israel Bond group awarded me, and then of course I had the academic awards. I was elected to Phi Beta Kappa and Sigma Psi. So I guess I've had my share.
Yes, and I'm glad you had it. It's recorded for history. Hope you didn't leave anything out. You did mention the Westinghouse Order of Merit, I think.
Yes.
Okay. The other thing that we haven't touched on, unless you have some other remarks to make about some of your friends and associates, if it was interesting, would you like to mention any of those people you had contacts with, if any?
I mean, in terms of business or in terms of community affairs?
Yeah, community affairs, something that would require recording, let's say, as part of your life.
Well, as far as my career at Westinghouse, I got to meet a lot of the people, including the chairman, and that was over the years, and the presidents, etc. As far as my own business is concerned, of course, that pertained to nuclear energy, and so I got to meet a lot of the utility executives and also people in Congress, because this business is a highly regulated business. And there were a number of occasions in which I had to... there was a committee called kind of Joint Committee on Atomic Energy. And I got to be very friendly with Chet Holofield and got to know a number of other people on the committee. I used to testify quite frequently and as a matter of fact, was responsible for holding up legislation on the private ownership of uranium for a couple of years. As a result of my testimony, eventually they passed a bill providing for private ownership of uranium, which I felt was a disaster, but in any event, they eventually did it. And in my subsequent activities, I've gotten to meet a lot of congressmen, senators, labor leaders. I started an organization in 1975 called Americans for Energy Independence. This was a national organization which is still in existence, has offices in Washington, and the first president of that organization was Admiral Zumwalt.
Famous.
And in the course of forming this, I arranged for a number of Nobel Prize winners to be on the board of directors, including, I shouldn't have said Zumwalt was the president. The president actually was Hans Bethe, who was a Nobel Prize winner. Zumwalt was the executive director, executive vice president.
What was his position in the Navy? Didn't he have a...
Well, he was retired at the time.
Oh, I see.
But he was, I think he was head of the Joint Chiefs or the head of the Naval... Joint Chiefs, I think he was.
Was he Jewish?
Oh, no.
Sounded like it. I always wondered.
He turned out to be quite a character, too. As a matter of fact, I was not only responsible for hiring him, I was also responsible for firing him.
Wow, that's terrific.
That was quite a...
He's quite a figure in the history of this country.
Yeah, he's quite a figure in the history of the country. You know, there are a lot of people who are famous in the history of our country who have a hell of a lot of warts on them.
True.
And he's got his share.
Yeah. Your Committee for Energy Independence.
Yes.
Is what?
Americans for Energy Independence was formed with the objective of sensitizing the people in this country to the problems that we had, particularly as a result of oil shortages, and to do what we could, not only in sensitizing, but educating them and doing what we could to influence the direction of legislation.
You mean to develop atomic power?
Is that
for what?
No, the idea was to develop alternates or alternate means of energy to replace oil, on which we were obviously very much dependent. I had, in 1973, just before in June or July of 1973, there was a Zionist organization at the American Convention in Texas, and I was asked to give the keynote speech, and I spoke on the whole issue of the influence of Arabs on the oil business. And then we had, of course, the Yom Kippur War. And subsequent to that, there was the Arab oil embargo, which created all of this problem. So we were kind of, I guess we were a little prophetic in our feelings. In 1975, I worked on this 2 years, as a matter of fact, to get this thing going. This was formed, and during the course of that, Governor Peabody of former governor of Massachusetts was a member of my board, and Bob Mason, who was an economist in Washington, who was in the Roosevelt administration. And there were a lot of very famous people who are on the board of directors of this organization, and still are. I say during the course of the formation of this, I got to know I.W. Abel quite well. And among the people who became, like, convinced ought to become a member of the board of AFEI, where it was the president of AFL-CIO. He was then secretary.
Yeah.
And
his name is, I can't think of it myself. I can see it. Do you know his name? Sure.
What happened was that he resigned after the meeting that we had with Zumwalt, which Zumwalt was fired. Basically, he said he resigned. It was either he or I. And that was a very tough meeting, I must say, with Bob Mason and Peabody and myself and Zumwalt and Hans Bethe. And the current president of AFL-CIO. And he thought I was, he thought I was pretty rough on Zumwalt, so he decided when Zumwalt said he was going to resign, then he would also resign. So I got to know quite a few.
I know, you did rub elbows with famous people. But tell us, was this the period that nuclear energy was begun, or was it in the talking stage? Nuclear power plants.
When were they started? Much earlier. The first one was the shipping port reactor.
Right here in Pennsylvania.
Which I worked on. And as a matter of fact, was responsible for the development of the fuel for that reactor. It started out as a reactor. It wasn't shipping port. It was a reactor for an aircraft carrier. That was what the intention was. And then, apparently, funds were not allocated for it, for the aircraft carrier at that time, and the whole project was converted into a project for peaceful nuclear power. And that's when shipping port got started. Eventually, an aircraft carrier was built, mm-hmm. utilizing
nuclear energy. Do you remember the year that was? I have no record.
Well, let's see. I had already resigned from Bettis in 57, and I believe that plant was dedicated in 1958, is my recollection, and Eisenhower was responsible for it. It was the Eisenhower administration at the time, and Eisenhower was responsible for pressing the button that started the ball rolling.
Isn't that historical? Right in our backyard. Was it Duquesne Light
Duquesne Light operated it on behalf of the government. It was part of the system. And it was decommissioned quite recently.
Was it worn out?
Well, it was no longer, it was a small plant, it was not very economic to run it, and it was basically an experimental plant, and the Congress saw fit not to, or the Atomic Energy Commission, or whatever it is at the time, saw fit not to continue its operation. It had outworn its usefulness.
Yeah. See, now, I'm one of the few, the many out there, that thought that that plant was part of the light and the energy that we're getting.
Sure it is.
It was?
It was.
I see. But it wasn't the most... I mean, there were other facilities besides that producing power, wasn't there?
Well, this was the first...
of its kind.
...power plant to produce nuclear power for peaceful purposes on a comparatively large scale.
Good.
There were other plants that were built subsequent to that, and that's when the peaceful nuclear power era really started.
Yeah. Well, here's a good question then. How do you feel today in 1984 about the fact that nuclear plants are being closed down right and left? There has been none built for I don't know how many years. That is, none has been finished. Is that correct?
Oh, no, that's not so.
Not true?
There are many plants that are being finished now that
really?
Have started.
Okay.
They're being commissioned. New plants are being commissioned essentially every year. But there have been a number of plants that have been canceled. But new plants are being built overseas all the time, in Japan and Korea and Taiwan and France.
How do you feel about the attitude in this country, though? Anti-nuclear demonstrations? Feeling
well,
it's not
they're
safe?
Certainly not. There's. I guess the anti-nuclear demonstrations did a lot to provide perhaps a more more sensitive it sensitized, I think, the designers and constructors more to the necessity for care in design and construction, and from that standpoint probably was useful. But for the most part, I think it's been these things have been disastrous because basically nuclear power is very clean power. It produces no gaseous effluents. It doesn't contaminate the atmosphere. And in effect, it's a gift that God gave us at a time when we really needed it, which we have rejected here in the United States.
Do you think
primarily as a result of ignorance?
Do you feel that the fact that there's no way to get rid of the nuclear waste causes people? Well, see, people are uninformed.
That's not true.
The feeling is we have no place to put the waste. I'm telling you about the rank and file feelings.
Well, that's not true.
All right, let's hear it.
The disposition of nuclear waste has been worked on for many, many years, and there have been a number of ways devised for assuring that the nuclear waste is fixed. Basically, the problem is to assure that the waste, when it's disposed of, does not contaminate the environment.
Right.
And particularly does not contaminate groundwater and get dispersed throughout the ground. And there are ways of doing this. For example, one of the ways that they do it is to mix the material with a glassy substance, which is very inert and which is insoluble, and then they encapsulate these big bars of glassy material in multiple capsules of very corrosion resistant material, and then these are buried in could be buried in salt mines.
Okay.
And the reason that they selected salt mines is that salt accumulated there because there's no water. had there been water, that salt would have dispersed. It would have dissolved and dispersed. So the idea is to put it into places where there is no groundwater, or to put it into rocky granite or basalt formations where these things could reside untouched for millennia, where they wouldn't do any harm. But one thing that people, I think, don't realize is that there is a lot of, when you talk about waste, it's really not a waste, it's a byproduct material. When uranium fissions, it fissions into material which is roughly half the atomic weight of the uranium. And these are highly radioactive. Some of the material, for example, strontium, was used for sterilizing medical supplies. Cobalt can be used for that, and so on. But it can be used for sterilization of medical supplies. It can be used for pasteurization of food.